1997, I'm in my second interview with Marilyn Robinson for Sherna Gluck's oral history class at Cal State Long Beach. And here we go. I have seven follow-up questions from our last time.
Okay.
A couple of them will be quick and some of them won't. In listening to the tapes, I heard you mentioned several times you grew up in a traditional background. And you use the word traditional quite a bit, and I need you, for the record, to define what traditional means to you.
Okay, to me, I think what it was really being a part of the culture around us in an everyday sense. My father went to the longhouse. That was his religion. I went with him, and the traditionalism that is taught from that in terms of how you're supposed to act and how you're supposed to be, and just participating in these things. Blockhouse events.
Okay.
That's what I see it as, anyway.
Okay. Also, if there is, can you spell your mother's clan?
Turtle.
Oh, okay, but there was another language, the
Mohawk and Cayuga. And they both spoke both languages.
Okay, can you spell that language for me?
Cayuga.
Thank you. I was trying to work out. I'm like, okay, then I have to ask for spelling on that one. Okay. When you spoke about your mother's role as president of the women's group
mm-hmm.
on the reservation.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe what that group was, what they did, what their role was?
Okay, in Canada, they have a system, especially in the farm countries out in the West and in all the farm communities, they had what they call women's institutes.
Mm-hmm.
And all these farming communities had these women's institutes that met and worked on community issues. Whatever was going on in the community. And so they did, certain things like make things for the hospital, if the hospital needed some help, or Indian hospital. They got involved in starting the library in the village. Now these were just all Indian women in the community. And if somebody was in trouble, they helped them. I remember one time one of the young girls got pregnant and she wasn't married, and lo and behold, she had twins. So the women's group gave her a shower
mm-hmm.
to help her out. Things like that, were both individual kinds of things and community oriented, both kinds.
Did they work in conjunction with white groups, or was it just the
reservation? No, it was just the reservation. But then there was the broader, like in this country, they have the General Federated Organization of Women's Clubs or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I belonged to the Indian Women's Club here, we were a part of that. But they had much more control than the Women's Institutes had in Canada. They were really loosely connected, but then they would have a convention once a year where all these women's institutes came together.
And did your mother go to those
women? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And some of the other women would go. And because they had them in regions.
Mm-hmm. Would her organization ever do political work?
No, they were not political. Uh-uh. No, it was much more I guess you could call it a social work kind of thing. But they did get involved in, the activities. And when we had our Indian Fair, they were very active in helping organize that and run the women's section and stuff.
Okay. Yeah, that clears it up.
Yeah.
How would you describe, I just wanted to elaborate a little, how would you describe your mother and your sister? Just kind of give me, we talked a lot about them, but
mm-hmm.
kind of more specifically, how would you describe each woman?
My mother was a very strong woman in a very quiet way. She was a very hard worker, and she was just very calm, very quiet, and got things done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to describe because
yeah.
I could see her doing all these things, and yet she was not a, you know, to push people to things. Somehow or other, she got people to get involved with these things.
The one about your sister?
My older sister was really quite different. She was never involved in any of the community things. She was much more oriented towards, you know, working in the house and things. But she still had a strong role in the family.
After your mother died, she took care
of she took care of the whole family in many ways.
I just wanted to get a little bit of a better picture. Were there any types of activist groups on the reservation, political activists?
The old day, well, we called the Mohawk workers. I don't know what they did, but they were political activists.
I think many of them really were trying to go back to some of the traditional Klan ways. That was it, although they were never really focused. And there was a lot of political activism in terms of, keeping the traditional political organization, political clan structure alive.
Amongst the structure that was, because we had talked about the structure changing.
Yeah, they wanted the old traditional structure.
So they sort of have this dual structure.
Still problems today.
But I think the traditional structure is having more power today.
It was interesting. I was coming through Barnes & Noble this morning, and they had a book about traditional India. It's called, I think, Native Americans in the 20th Century. And I looked at the price on it. It was $95. I thought it was going to stay on the shelf. You know, Barnes & Noble, you can sit down and read. So I sat down and I read. And I thought they had a very accurate description of my tribe, the Tiuga. And they pointed out that, the traditional political structure has stayed intact in spite of the onslaught and is becoming stronger.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really good. This is a beautiful book. And there's a lot of contributions to it. $95.
That's a little much.
It's gorgeous, but I think that as a resource for people who are looking at this in the 20th century, it's probably one of the best ones.
So, in terms of that, the dual political system, do you remember any particular political activities that may or may not have affected you or your family? I mean, was there any, a time period where this group, the Mohawk workers, was there ever a time period where anything that they did, your family became involved in directly?
No. My dad was very involved, in delegations to Ottawa, to the capital, for rights for the Indians. And under the Jay Treaty of 1794, we were allowed free border crossing. And it stated in the Treaty of Goods and Services that, and forth. So they were involved in that, and that was called the Indian Defense League. They were never really actively involved in the league, but every summer in July they would go to what we call Border Crossing Day, and it still goes on today. 1 year they go from Fort Erie to Buffalo and back, and then next year to Niagara Falls, back. They march over the bridge to emphasize this fact that it's an open border for our people. So they did those things. So I was always aware of all those things going on.
Was it just men involved in
the war? No, men or women too. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, let's finish this one. One of the questions, because I had to do short tape abbreviations for my professor.
Mm-hmm.
I go through and I abbreviate tape, just in the section. And we were talking about my abbreviation, and we talked about you're getting married to a non-Indian. And in that conversation, a question came up. And what that question was, you seem to be strongly identified, obviously. You're strongly identified with your culture.
Mm-hmm.
So can you elaborate on how it is that you met and married a non-Indian?
Not really. I don't really think that that has really much to do with your identification in the culture. You've got two people, and even though I was and I am, I still very much strongly, I've worked in Indian communities all my life, I don't really see a problem in
that. I guess the reason I ask is because the debate among African American communities and other racial communities about marrying outside your race is so strong.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it's just, what kind of atmosphere was around you at the time that it wouldn't even have occurred to you that this was going to be?
I think it's just an acceptance of people.
Mm-hmm. So, I guess we talked about it a little bit.
Yeah.
I just want to clarify. It wasn't a big political step, or it wasn't a big social taboo?
Nothing. No.
Was it done kind of regularly in the area that you grew up in?
Some did, yeah. Yeah, a lot. For instance, we had the monkey barracks in the village, and several of the girls who were teaching school married some of the monkeys. Yeah, it just...
wasn't an issue.
It wasn't an issue. Okay, and just, I always remember when Joyce Hill married one of my buddies, everybody says, oh, isn't that nice? He's such a nice man.
That was it, and he was.
He was a very nice man. All Indians liked him. He fit really well into the community, although he wasn't Indian. And that was fun. Everybody thought that was really nice thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about that it just seems as though where you grew up in Canada, things like interracial marriages and education, just everything seems to be so much more assimilated. Not even assimilated, just
accepted.
Coexisting,
nice, yeah.
I should say.
Yeah. Well, I think that goes back, as I said, to the fact we've been reservation in 1784.
Yeah. I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah.
That wasn't, I know personally it wasn't an issue. I didn't know about it personally.
No. Okay. I suppose if it was, I wouldn't have noticed it too much, but then, but no, it really wasn't, and I think it was that, it was sort of that acceptance of, of who was the individual.
Okay. Your last follow-up question. I just want to clarify, because we talked a little bit about your time in Berkeley. You had three kids when you were in Berkeley.
No, two.
Two kids.
Mm-hmm.
And you had been married. You were obviously married.
Mm-hmm.
You were there for a year.
3 years.
3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about any of the activism that happened there?
There was nothing going on. That was the 50s.
A
little early for any activism. There was nothing going on in Berkeley. Berkeley was very much part of the 50s.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was there 54 to 57. And I was just a young graduate student raising two kids and nothing. So, graduate student.
I can't imagine being a graduate student and raising kids. That's just...
It was a lot, in those days there were a lot of married graduate students.
Yeah.
And, and the wife was very much a traditional stay-at-home wife and raising the kids. The little money that graduate students made as a teaching assistant.
Wow, I can't imagine that.
I don't know.
I'm poor and everything it is. I can't imagine having kids on top of it.
You didn't think about it then, but you think about it later and you think, oh my God, yeah.
funny how you just get by without even
thinking.
Get by.
But I remember we rented a little house for $75 a month. And not too far from the campus. Now you can't rent anything. Of course, we didn't have any money anyway, but that was the first place we rented, I think, was $65 a month. And we moved into this little house for $75 a month. And then stayed there until we finished the camp.
Okay, I'll just check out when you next around my time was.
Yeah, 54 and 57.
Pretty quiet.
Oh, yes, it was nothing going on there.
It didn't start till the 60s.
Yeah.
Were you involved after, when you were here in the 60s?
Yeah, came to San Diego in 61, June of 61.
And we left off with, and that's when the activism started.
Let's see,
I think your last couple words were, that's about the time when you're socializing and you're visiting transgressed to activism.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So let's start with that.
Well, in the late 60s, 68 or 69, I joined the United Indian Women's Club here, which was just forming. And also the California Indian Education Association, which was just forming. They had their first meeting in 68, and I joined it in 69. You're bad this morning. So bad. So those two organizations sprang up about the same time, obviously, for the Indian Education Association, which is still very active in Northern California, not so much down here. Emphasizing the need for education, higher education. And then the United Indian Women's Club started really, one of our first tours was really looking at education. We had an education unit and we helped students get into college and helped them with their financial aid. And Long Beach actually was one of the focal points. There was a young Indian there by the name of Dan Bummery at the time. And so we worked with Dan. Dan comes from my grand, actually. When we got to know each other, found out that his grandmother and my mother were first cousins.
Small world.
And so some of the students from here, there were two students from here from San Diego that went out to Long Beach. And then when they got there, not that financial aid was done or anything, and they had been told it was. So we got involved in that. We went up and we met with them at the school. And forced through both with the BIA at the school, but it wasn't the students' fault. They didn't know what was going on. Also, I was on the board, the early board at the UCLA to set up the Indian Studies program at UCLA. The Indian students there were just organizing, so I was sent from the Indian Women's Club to be part of that. And so we were involved in a lot of the educational issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Alcatraz, have you read the, was it Through the Hurricane or something like that? It's just a new book out.
No, there's a couple new books out. Troy's actually written a new one on Alcatraz too, and I haven't been able to get a hold of it.
Yeah, he said he was going to send me a copy. So I'm waiting.
He's out of print in the bookstore, so I'm waiting for the next shipment.
Okay, because he said, I want to send you a copy. I said, well, good. So anyway, then when Alcatraz came along, and at that point, we had been working with the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Riverside. Two of us went up there to find out what happened to the students who had put in for the BIA scholarships. And we found they were still sitting in the in-basket on somebody's desk. So we got angry about that.
Was this San Francisco State University?
No, this was the... That was for UC Riverside.
Okay.
And that was for the Riverside office of the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that's where all the students here, they've since moved it to Sacramento, but
okay.
At those years, they got their scholarship money out of the Riverside office for the local Indians.
Okay.
And we did things like meeting with the high school superintendents and teachers and counselors to get them to work better with our students here. So I was involved in a lot of that kind of educational stuff, pushing on schools, making trouble, I guess, what you want to call it, with trying to get them to understand our Indian students and to work better with them. And I was at UCLA, I was at a meeting at UCLA when Richard Oakes came there to talk about the fact that they were going to be going on to Alcatraz and wanted our support, which we gave them.
Was it 1958?
I think it was about 70, I think it was. I'm trying to, you know, when did they go on, when did they land on Alcatraz?
Well, they did two short.
Yeah, this would be the one second long. One. This was the second one when Richard Oakes was involved.
I think it was the summer of 69.
Yeah, so
late
it was then. Yeah, I think it was late 69. I'll have to check this book because they got all the dates. This is a very good book, by the way. So we gave our support from the UCLA committee. There was a man by the name of Elijah Smith. He was an Oneida Indian, and he had taught. He was a coach at one of the colleges, and then there was another man by the name of Wallace. Now then there was one of the big committee. She lived in L.A. There were a number of us who were on this committee to get the Indian Studies Fund. And so Richard Oakes came there, and then I came back to the Indian Women's Club and told them what was going on. So we also wrote a letter of support for what was happening there. Alcatraz. And at that point then we collected money and food and everything else and sent up, and a couple of our people went up. Our kids went up. My son went to Alcatraz, the oldest one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was at Alcatraz for about a week. He and another student from UC student. And so we were all very supportive of this, and at the same time working locally to support the larger efforts. But I think a lot of our action was really through the California Indian Education Association, Dave Risling, Raymond Brightman, Morgan Otis. We were all very much giving workshops, doing presentations at various colleges, community colleges, universities, to point out the need for this.
Would that be similar to consciousness raising, or would it be similar to what you do now in your workshop?
I think it was much more consciousness raising. It was a lot more confrontational. Mm-hmm. It was really pretty confrontational with some of these teachers and some of the professors.
What kind of reactions did you get?
Oh, some of them were really negative, really negative. I can remember one time we did one at Stanislaus State out in the valley, and one of the comments made to us, well, you know, especially to me as a woman, one of the male teachers said to me, well, how can you call yourself an Indian and have a college degree? You know, so I said, I didn't realize that once you got a college degree, your ethnic identity changed. And so there was a lot of, like, hostile stuff that came up. And then, I remember George Ekman, he's passed away now, but he was a minister, and so he and, another minister that was with him, and they were much more fundamentalist. And they were also on the panel. And one of the teachers said, you know, well, I noticed all you men always wear cowboy boots. What's the reason behind that? Now, this followed a presentation on curriculum development. And so it had nothing to do with personal kind of stuff. We talked about curriculum development and pushing through the inclusion of Indian history into the curriculum. So the comments that came back were really had nothing to do with content that had been delivered. But it's really hostile, I think, because we were seen as only we all had college degrees, and we were all seen as really out of our realm to be able to be doing that. So it was that kind of stuff that went on. It was kind of individual attacks on them. And this was common.
So, like, in in respect to that comment that you, that the woman made about the cowboy boots, was it like, you either need to be assimilated or you don't?
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah. It was that once you get a college education, you get a degree, then you're no longer able to recognize the Indian component because now you've assimilated. See, because, and it may be, for so long in this history here, is that education was pushed to give up this side. So if you became educated, you couldn't be both.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the educational system was for so long. You read it in the Indian history stuff, and that's how it was seen. And I think that's how, and these were all non-Indians, I think that's how they saw it.
Mm-hmm.
That here we were, in a sense, threatening them because we were more like them, and yet we weren't.
Mm-hmm. That's just because you can come at them at a level that they theoretically should have understood.
That's right, and they disliked it. So instead of attacking our content or anything else, they attacked us personally. Yeah, and that was common. That was really common.
Let me just get a couple things straight. Yeah, you had a college degree at this point. Were you still enrolled in school?
Let's see. I got my degree in 65.
Mm-hmm.
In anthropology from San Diego State.
Right.
Then in 69, I was in graduate school at UCSD in sociology and a PhD program.
And your oldest son was in college at this point?
He was just a senior in high school.
So, yeah,
mm-hmm. Taking classes at the community college.
And the Indian women's group that you got involved with, was that how did you first become involved in that? What was the first thing that made you become involved?
I just heard about it, and I went to one of the meetings, and it was really mainly the reservation and the into the urban area, and they were just so nice and so friendly, and I just felt so at home.
So they said,
you've got to join.
So I joined. Did you seek it out at first for social reasons or for political
reasons? Yeah, for more social reasons, yeah.
And did you socialize on top of everything else? Was socialization a big factor in that group?
In what sense?
Well, I mean, was the primary goal to always be involved in the education, or was the primary goal of that group to provide support and a way to socialize?
No, I think basically it was to work on education. That right from the very beginning, their first meeting, they talked about that our kids need help. The schools are very racist. The schools treat their kids this way, and you've got to do something about it. I think that was the focal point from what I recall.
The women, they were reservation women primarily.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Were their kids shipped off the reservation to go to school?
No, because at that point, California Indian kids were not allowed to go to Sherman Indian High School, believe it or not, because California is what we call a public legislative state, so the kids had to go to the local schools. And it wasn't really until in the 70s that the Indian kids here were allowed to go to Indian boarding schools.
Okay. So they were bused off to
the Baltimore. Yeah. For right from the very beginning, mm-hmm. The only Indian school that's around is the one at Pollock, the mission school. Mm-hmm. And now the mission has pulled out, Catholic Gordon has pulled out, but it was Catholic school. So a lot of them sent their kids there for elementary school, but then they all had to go to World High School, which was really pretty, I guess racist was the only way. There's a lot of things that were happening at school, and that's why we would meet with the
principal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to go back up and clarify some things. So you supported Alcatraz.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you went up to UCLA to help start the Indian Studies program, in what capacity did you go? Did you go just as a member of this this club?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you didn't go as an academic.
No. I went as an Indian supporter to explain to school, like all we were all there, why it was necessary to support our kids.
What was the reaction when this committee of people that were there wrote a letter to support the students of the San Francisco?
since we were a community advisory board.
So I know. I don't know if there was any repercussion.
Did it hinder, that, did anybody use that against you?
No, not that I recall. No.
I think at that point there was so much going on
that I think they were just constantly on guard.
Because it was always something coming.
What's next? And they didn't really quite know how to handle a lot of this stuff. And then I remember one time, this was really a funny story. We were interviewing for the head of the Indian Studies program. And the two men who were coming in, one was a historian by the name of Roger Buffalo, a punk Indian, and the other one man was a man by the name of Brown Pipestand. I can't remember Brownie's, either of his,